You have to start with change, one community at a time, for transformation to happen.
A holistic approach that integrates innovation, inclusion, and financing can unlock the full potential of marine and coastal management and science.
Welcome to the seventh episode of Season 3 of Ocean Insight, the podcast series brought to you by the Meyvesen Initiative and the UN Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development. My name's Kira G. I'm an MSP expert and scientist working at Helmholtz-Zentrum Herion in Germany.
My name is Alison Clausen. I'm the Deputy Director of the UN Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development at UNESCO's Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission. And Kira and I are delighted to be your co-hosts for the podcast. It's hard to believe, but this is the final episode of Season 3. And what an episode we have for you today. So the focus of this final episode is quite broad, but we really want to focus on what it takes to enable lasting sustainability transformation for the ocean and for the human communities that depend on it. You'll remember in our previous episodes, we've talked about a lot of different facets of sustainable management of the ocean, sustainable development, sustainable ocean economy. But what does it really take to ensure that we get that lasting sustainability? So we're going to discuss the preconditions for sustainability transformation from a regional perspective, a local perspective, a global perspective, and we're going to specifically look at the role of innovation, inclusion, and of course, finance, and how they can be linked more effectively. So our wonderful guests today are Dr. Jacqueline Uku, Chair of the African Ocean Decade Task Force, our former WIOMSA President and Senior Researcher at the Kenya Marine and Fisheries Research Institute, amongst other things, because I know you have many other titles. And we also have Dr. Abdoulaye Diagana, the Programs Coordinator from the Abidjan Convention Secretariat. And wonderful to have you here, Abdoulaye, as well. A very warm welcome to both of you. As we get started, perhaps I can ask you both to just introduce yourselves briefly and let people know what you're working on at the moment and what some of your current interests are in your professional world. So Jacqueline, we'll start with you and then over to Abdoulaye.
Thank you very much, Alison. Very happy to be here. I'm a marine scientist by profession, working in Mombasa, Kenya. Worked in the field of seagrass science for about 30 years. And I've been just leading different initiatives, currently chairing the Africa Decade Task Force and the initiative to bring transformation to Africa's engagement with the ocean. And more lately, I'm interested in ocean literacy aspects, thinking, working through how to get ocean knowledge really, really entrenched amongst not only coastal populations, but also populations that are far from the sea. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm really happy to be here discussing with you on ocean issues. I'm Abdoulaye Diagana. I'm a geographer and environmentalist working for the Abidjan Convention Secretariat, which is a part of the UN family. UNEP, United Nations Environment Programme. And we are covering, the Abidjan Convention is covering, the whole Atlantic coast of Africa from Mauritania to South Africa. I'm now working on governance issues, cooperation tools, international cooperation, etc., creating MPAs, and fighting against biodiversity loss and pollution, among others.
Thank you. Yeah, great to have you both. Thank you very much. So the first question I have is really a very broad one and a very general question in the context of our podcast. Transformation is something that we talk a lot about these days, isn't it, in the context of sustainable oceans, but also more broadly when it comes to coastal management, for example. So I wanted to ask you, from your perspective, what do you think transformation actually means? And here we're talking about sustainability transformation or transforming our oceans, our communities, towards more sustainable communities, more sustainable ocean. And I wanted to ask, how is that different somehow, transformation from just change or the kind of development that we are experiencing anyway? I'm going to ask Jacqueline first.
Thank you very much, Kira, for that question. Indeed, transformation has become a buzzword. I think we have to cast our minds to really understand what we should be looking for when we talk about transformation. And when you compare it with just mere change, for me, change is really small scale. It happens perhaps in pockets. While I see transformation being a greater societal change that is upscaled with bigger actions, more people taking charge of sustainable development, being part of that discourse. So I think transformation for me is larger. But then I also sense that you have to start with change, one community at a time for transformation to happen. There has to be a learning of what was the best practice, what brought about the change. And can this change be upscaled? Can it be copied? Can it be transferred through peer learning? I think those are the elements that are critical and important to see transformation happen.
That's a really interesting perspective, a really sort of bottom-up approach, really, in a way, starting from small. I like the way you describe it, from these pockets of change to then upscale this to a much bigger impact, a bigger transformative change that we then have as a result. What would you say are some of the biggest challenges still or opportunities from stopping sustainability transformation from becoming a reality, especially if we think of the interconnections between local, national, and maybe the global scale?
Okay, let me give it a shot. What happens with transformation agendas and policies, they tend to remain at the policy level. Very little comes down and is mainstreamed at the community level where most action takes place, where custodianship of these resources is. So I think the biggest challenge is, do these messages come down? Do people have the awareness of what they do, especially upstream and its impact in the ocean? I'll give an example for Kenya, where if we keep on cutting out trees in our forests, our oceans will continue to become browner because of sedimentation being carried down during heavy rainfalls like the ones we experience now. So the biggest challenge is the fact that we're not talking to the right people, or the messaging, the behavior change is not happening in the right places. As government, we understand, but do the people doing harm do they really understand? Are governments creating opportunities and alternatives for what they really need and providing this to them? But then we have big opportunities. And these opportunities, I think, range across, and I'll borrow quite a bit from the high-level panel transformation agenda, because the rally call for the high-level panel is really transformation leading towards a sustainable ocean economy. And clearly, we have to have alignment with sustainable development, climate change goals, the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Paris Agreement, because these set the targets. They give us something to aim for, something to try to achieve. And so this alignment usually is at policy level, but I think that knowledge needs to be brought down. And it's brought down by inclusion, equity, participation of all, including Indigenous people. Having them participate in dialogues around these global, international, national commitments that have been made. we have opportunity to share knowledge, especially from science, the best available science that can give knowledge on what our current status is, the baselines on which to build up maybe new innovations, technology, but also not forgetting indigenous knowledge, the fact that in our past history, we have maintained and sustained the oceans traditionally. It's not just the modern way that is important. We have to look at the traditional, the ancient way, because that too counts. Alignment of governance management regimes then should be downscaled. We have opportunities for those. So that we begin to see that that we do have sustainable ocean development and ocean use. And the only way we would know that we are being sustainable is if we can be assured and we can assure that we'll always have a productive ocean, even as we continue to use it. I think I would stop there.
Thanks, Jacqueline. Abdoulaye, would you like to comment?
Yes, I totally agree with Jackie, and yes, we need once again to work to be sure that we involve everyone and to insist on the indigenous knowledge, local communities. They are the first who are in contact with the ocean, and they know how to deal with the ocean. So we need to involve them, and not only starting by the higher level and trying to continue with them. Talking about challenges, we all know that the political will, it's not the same everywhere. And many governments prioritize short-term economic interests, although they are aware that we need to do something to protect our planet. Or another challenge I can also see is the situation of the governance, the fragmented governance we have of oceans and coast, and multiple agencies and jurisdictions. We here in Abidjan Convention, we are working to see how to make it more efficient. Another challenge we also have, that it's the resource constraints. Everything is a priority in some countries, and the funds are limited, capacities are also really limited, and this poses a significant challenges to implementing sustainable management practices. A last one, maybe I will end with the conflict of interest. I don't know if it's the same everywhere, but in the region I'm working into, conflicting interest among stakeholders, such as between conservationists and fishing communities, or between coastal development and biodiversity conservation. This can hinder consensus building and collective action for sustainability. We use here MSP, Marine Spatial Planning, and we are collaborating with some partners to see how to use the Marine Spatial Planning to solve or to avoid conflicts between stakeholders.
Thanks, Jacqueline and Abdoulaye, for these very, very interesting perspectives on some of the opportunities, but also the challenges. And we can see that there are many challenges, but it's interesting listening to you because it sounds like there is still optimism. You're still seeing pathways that we can follow to achieve this sustainability transformation. So now I want to look at some of the more specific enablers, some of the more specific things that we need to put in place to overcome some of those challenges that you've just been talking about. Could you perhaps, let's start with innovation and technology. Could you start, and maybe we'll start again with you, Jacqueline, the kind of innovation and technology that is going to be needed to push transformation and overcome some of those challenges that you were just talking about?
Okay, it's interesting that we've nosed down to innovation and technology. And I want to look at this in the context of marine spatial planning, because it's a process that I see being an enabler of the dialogues. They need an enabler of bringing sectors together to have very, very difficult conversations over the ocean space, its uses, and not just ocean-based practitioners and resource users, but also people far removed from the ocean. So I see marine spatial planning as one of those tools that are very critical. But one thing we find, even as we go through this process, is the fact that sometimes we need to have a bit more innovation to be able to collect data. And I'm seeing my team using digital tools to be able to collate information from different actors, different players. We don't have to meet physically. As long as I send you a link, you're able to feed in information that is much needed for this process. I'm seeing the need for different types of innovations to help us map spaces, innovations that help us begin to create scenarios about how marine spaces should look like, how we can resolve conflict. We need a tremendous amount of innovation there to be able to come to a consensus on the best use of marine space and the best use of that space, not only for us as governments or nationally, internationally, but also at the level of the communities. I'll stop there.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And it also shows some of the links between innovation and then some of the tools, the planning and management tools that were needed. And Abdullah, I'd like to bring you in here and see whether you have additional thoughts on innovation technology or indeed the more innovative planning and management tools that we really need to undertake this sustainability transformation in a very practical and concrete way.
Jacqueline has almost covered everything. So maybe here in I have already mentioned what we are doing in the framework of the GMS and Africa program here. For example, we developed applications, apps, or some tools that helps to using satellite or Earth observation tools to monitor the activities in ocean or coastal zone, to collect data, even sometime working with the fishermen, or to see how our ecosystems are reacting or evolving, facing the pollution issues, etc. This is the kind of thing I think we can use here in our region. Knowing that resources are limited, so technology could be a powerful asset to help us to better manage our coast and coastal and marine zone.
Yeah, I like that. And I think what you're also made a really important point there, that innovation and technology needs to be adapted to the context as well, and to the resources that are available, and to the local and the regional needs. So I think that's something very important to keep in mind, that it's not one size fits all when it comes to technology and innovation for a sustainability transformation.
You're totally right. You summarize it as it should be, and as the threat is global, I think that the countries who has means and wealth need to know that they have to develop solidarity to work together with those who are limited in resources, so that we can be sure that everything is covered. Otherwise, we will have some gray zones not covered. And as this threat is no boundaries, the problem will continue to be the same for all of us.
Absolutely. Very, very important point. The sea knows no boundaries as such. It's just us
exactly.
humans really that keep imposing them, aren't we? But it also goes to show that, you know, it's so important to think of ways of collaborating and you know, cooperating much more at very, very different levels. And I'd like to come back to a point that I think it was Jacqueline, you made it earlier, you know, on the importance of including different knowledge holders, different types of knowledge, people really, making sure that we are talking to the right people, that MSP, for example, or other management tools are inclusive enough of all the different voices that matter in ocean management. But I wanted to come back to you and again ask you, Jacqueline, first, you know, say in a nutshell, why it is just so important to have full inclusion, to be equitable in the processes that we do, and why participation is so important specifically for transformation.
I'm just thinking of where to start. What I have found in my work is that for inclusion to take place, you really have to know where are the different genders in a landscape. Where are they placed in the landscape? Let's say the ocean landscape. Where are the women? Where do they work? Where do they get their resources from? Where are the men? Where are the youth? So for instance, we did one such exercise supported by IOC Africa, looking at gender and poverty and marine spatial planning. And it was very interesting to find that women work along the seashore. They will not go into deeper areas. Deeper areas are the reserve of men who have boats that will go out and fish and bring the fish back. Women will be gleaners. They'll, in our space in Kenya, you find women putting up seaweed farms close to the shoreline in the intertidal areas. So they'll be gleaning for mollusks, they'll be farming seaweed, they'll be at the shoreline waiting for the boats to come. They're the ones that receive the fish and take it to the market. And then also the youth, you know, where are they? Are they in which spaces do they occupy, if any at all? So it's important, I think, to have as a first step to understand where are they, what are they doing in this space? And then begin to map out and understand how can they be involved in decision making over the same spaces. Because often what happens is that if there is a coastal development, often the seashore will be the first to be impacted and women will lose their livelihood. So I think the mapping of where they play out their daily roles, where they what zones contribute to livelihood is very crucial in decision making for transformation. Even before they can participate and understand the benefits of any development, most cases they will be the women, the youth may be resettled simply because of development, but then understanding their benefits and what they accrue from that space is critical to make sure that even if they're resettled and they have to take up new spaces, they still can meet their livelihood needs.
I think that is such an important point that, you know, I think still women are totally underrepresented in many decision-making processes that are related to planning or MSP, and decisions are made so easily to relocate and not consider all the various value chains and the benefits and the roles different parts of communities play overall. Abdoulaye, let me ask you again also about you know, participation also in higher levels of decision making. I mean, we've said before that it's important to link, you know, the local level to the regional level to the global level. MSP, for example, often tends to be a national endeavour. So how do we make sure that we scale up that participation, and what can be done to achieve better participation at different levels, do you think?
As we say here and maybe everywhere, if you want to go fast go alone, and if you want to go far, wait for everyone and go with them. We all know that some groups are not involved in the process as they should. And to achieve full, equitable, inclusive, and effective, and even gender-responsive representation and participation in decision-making at different levels, several actions are needed. For example, to develop once again and enforce policies that promote inclusivity and diversity in decision-making processes. This might include mandates for gender balance on decision-making, for example, or requirements for consultations with indigenous communities. We also must build capacities. Many stakeholders, especially marginalized groups, may lack the knowledge or resources to participate effectively in decision-making. So if we want them to be involved and understand what they have to do, what is expected from them, they need to be informed. The decision-making processes should be accessible also to all stakeholders, regardless of their socioeconomic status or geographical location. This might involve providing translation, for example. It's something we can neglect, but it can make the difference. Translation services, ensuring physical accessibility to meeting spaces, or even utilizing digital platforms for remote participation. We need to pay also special attention to cultural sensitivity. Things are not the same everywhere. The true truth in the Nostrums it's not always true in the South. In many communities, traditional knowledge and practices play a crucial role in marine and coastal management. Decision making processes should respect and incorporate these cultural perspectives, ensuring that indigenous knowledge is valued alongside scientific expertise. I think that by implementing these strategies, stakeholders can work towards more inclusive, effective, and sustainable marine and coastal management practices that benefit both people and the environment. I will stop here.
Some excellent points there about how and why inclusivity is so important. Coming now to one of the final enablers, if you like, of a sustainability transformation, and no surprise, this is financing. I think in every conversation we've had during this podcast, a lot of it comes down to financing and investment and resources. And it seems fairly clear that the existing ways of financing ocean science and financing ocean knowledge and financing ocean conservation are not really going to cut it if we want to have this sustainability transformation. So Abdullah, I'd like to start with you. Could you talk a little bit about some of the more innovative or future types of financing instruments that you think would be needed to support transformation? For example, what sort of instruments, or how could we convince national governments to increase the proportion of spending on ocean and marine issues? How can we make sure that these issues around inclusivity and co-design improve the attractiveness of projects and of initiatives for both public investment but also private investment? Where do we start with this in terms of really changing the way we're thinking about financing and investment?
This one is a difficult one. Bringing together innovation, inclusion, and financing can be a powerful approach to drive transformation change if innovation is supported by inclusion. So first of all, we need to have everyone around the table. Also, if inclusion is supported by financing, Effective financing mechanism can ensure that as communities and stakeholders have the resources and capacity to actively participate in decision-making processes and benefit from innovative solutions. We can also achieve it if financing is supported by innovation. We need to dig and to see how we can use innovative financing mechanism to generate new sources of funding for marine and coastal management initiatives while also maximizing the impact of existing resources. For example, the use of NBS, nature-based solutions, and green infrastructures can leverage ecosystem services to generate revenue streams such as carbon offset credits or payments for ecosystem services. Similarly, the adoption of technology-driven solutions such as blockchain for transparent and efficient resource management can help attract private investors, investment and philanthropic funding. But also here, we need to be careful to not have greenwashing and all the mechanism, you know. Overall, a holistic approach that integrates innovation, inclusion, and financing can unlock the full potential of marine and coastal management and science, leading to lasting positive impacts on both ecosystems and communities. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I agree, a lot of it is about learning and, again, finding those instruments that are the most relevant to the context and that are attractive from an economic and a broader societal point of view. Jacqueline, over to you. Thoughts on innovative financing instruments, whether they be from private, public, or philanthropic sources that can really help with this transformation to sustainability.
I agree with what Abdullahi has shared. In our space, in the Western Indian Ocean, we've had experience with nature-based financing through blue carbon for mangroves, and looking forward to adding other ecosystems to this, like seagrass ecosystems, where benefits are shared and as an add-on to the mangrove benefit. And I think we've also had some experience with blue bonds in seashells. I think financing is critical. If we need to bring about transformation, there has to be funding. And I think more so funding from governments is very critical. So you find financing follows the business, financing follows the benefit, the profit. And not everything that we do for the oceans and in the ocean space can give a profit. So financing has to be tied to the fact that it's not everything that will be profitable, but there can be grants, philanthropic funding that can support that which may not be profitable, but the profit is more invisible in terms of the biodiversity benefit, the protection and conservation benefit. So I think there are profit, financing can be for profit and financing for conservation that then supports that which we can never quite put a cost on or value. The value is immeasurable. But I also want to add that from experience, especially from nature-based benefits and financing, the benefits to communities tend to be collective, a collective good that goes towards building a school, a library, a lab for the benefit of a bigger community. The shared benefits are acceptable, but often I think if we want transformation to happen, we really have to think a bit more innovatively to see what individual benefits can be accrued specifically Because when individuals see the benefit, then they see they can take up the agenda towards transformation. When individuals feel that specific benefit to them, then it's easier to bring about a collective change that leads towards transformation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that, Jacqueline. I really like the last piece you were saying about making those benefits very visible and very, very clear. But also what you were saying earlier on about it has to be a mix of financing types, right? Because not everything is going to give the return on investment that perhaps some private or even some public parties are looking for. So it's, again, finding that right mix of support and financing and then ensuring those benefits are very clear. So very, very rich food for thought from both of you to that very prickly question, which we know is a tricky one, but one that we really can't ignore.
Definitely, definitely. Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a rich conversation we've been having, and so many things that we touched upon that we'd love to go into more detail. But time is running out slowly but surely, and we are coming towards the end of our conversation. It's hard to believe, really. It's a wrap-up, not just for this episode, but for the whole season. So I'd like to take this opportunity to look towards the future with some optimism. It's easy to get disheartened by some of the developments, but there's also good grounds for hope. So I wanted to ask both of you, what makes you hopeful, you personally, that sustainability transformations can and will in fact be achieved for oceans on the one hand, for biodiversity, the all-important part really that is the foundation for many of the activities that we then do as humans, but also for those people, for the communities, for the individuals and for the broader communities. And let's start with you, Jacqueline.
Thank you, Eva. That's an interesting question. A few years ago, I recognized the fact that I've been part of a process. The fact that in doing my work, I used to think seagrasses were very insignificant for others, but very significant for me. And I've done my work silently, contributing here and there. And then one day, Nairobi, Kenya hosted the Blue Economy Conference. And what we've recognized is that everything we were doing in the oceans had a space. All of a sudden, one day, we were able to talk about the oceans with confidence because we'd been in the ocean, we understood, we'd been studying the ocean, and we were able to be part of the discourse. So I'd like to draw my optimism from that, in that the fact that countries are talking about their ocean spaces is radical. This is transformational, and I think that's the first step. For a long time, we just talked about agriculture, crops on land, animals on land. But now we are talking about blue foods. We are talking about seaweed farming. We are talking about crab farming, prawn farming. So I remain deeply optimistic that the future is bright simply because countries, nations, policymakers, our leaders are talking about the blue ocean. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think you're absolutely right, actually, looking back over the last 20 years. What a change has there been in the conversations we've been having about the ocean, and how much broader, how much more inclusive has it already become? I mean, of course, there's still a long way to go, but you're right. A lot actually has already changed towards the better. But Abdoulaye, what do you think? What makes you hopeful in terms of sustainability transformations for oceans and for people?
Thank you. While remaining realistic, I can't resist being optimistic. Firstly, because the situation can't get any worse. man has done a lot of damage to nature. We can also do better by putting our intelligence and genius at nature's service. It's all what we have to do now. We did the worst. Now it's time to do the best so we can to be we have to be intelligent and change our way to deal with Mother Nature. Thank you.
Absolutely. Why not do the best? That is so right. Oh, thank you so much to the both of you. It's been a fantastic episode, and what a nice ending to a really good season three, I would say.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly. A wonderful conversation, wonderful to end on an optimistic note, an optimistic yet realistic note. I like that very much. So thank you both so much. And of course, huge thanks to Kira, my wonderful co-host. It's been an absolute pleasure doing this season with you, and I hope we get to do it again.
The pleasure has been completely mine, and the compliment goes back to you, Alison. It's been wonderful to have you as a co-host. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. So bye-bye.
Well, what a fantastic episode to end season three on. It's been inspirational on so many levels, as have all the previous episodes. So thank you so much to all our guests over this season, and thank you, everyone, for joining us. If you want to catch up with previous episodes, go to the Meavison website, where you can also find links to the previous seasons. So stay tuned for future episodes, and of course, feel free to like and share with friends and colleagues.